afternoon, good evening. Welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, Elle Ariel, and I am recovering from a little bit of a head cold, so I apologize if I sound a little stuffed up, a little bit raspy. It is the cold and flu season for many of us, after all, so I'm sure you can all relate, but I got my Kleenex and I got my tea, and we're doing this. So I hope everyone had a great week. We can be reached again at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. We are on all the streaming platforms, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. I'd ask a little favor that if you are listening on one of those great streaming platforms, that you would give us a review, give us a good rating so we can get bumped up in the rankings and more people can find out about us. Because again, I think there's some amazing guests and amazing wisdom that is shared each week on the podcast for people that want to get into the music industry, that are looking for a career in music, or maybe want to move up to the next level, or are artists looking to expand their brand, their reach, to be more successful. Again, we talk to the movers and the shakers and the innovators in the industry and just get some amazing insight, experience, and inspiration for all y'all. So grateful for your continued support of the podcast. And if you can, yeah, just give us some love on the platforms, we would love that. Last week, I had the pleasure of interviewing Monty Malone, SVP of A&R Worldwide, just a great guy with a ton of experience, a real veteran in the music industry. And he's worked in studios, he's worked on music magazines, he's worked on promotion and record labels, and just he knows so much and was sharing a lot of insight about, you know, marketing and promotion and artist development, just a lot of great wisdom and good insight. So check on out that interview if you did not get a chance to before. Lucy Woodward is my next guest. I'm so excited. I was finally able to snag her with all her touring and projects and all the other million bazillion things that she has got going on. She is one busy lady continuously working in the industry. Lucy is a singer-songwriter, and she honed her craft in the mean streets of New York City and really made a name for herself. She was first signed by Tommy Mottola, then Atlantic, and she scored a top 40 hit. She co-wrote with her manager called Dumb Girls and another top 5 hit that she wrote for Stacey Orico, There's Gotta Be More to Life. I really do have a cold. Earning her 2 BMI awards, she has since gone into jazz, R&B with her album Hooked, released on Verve Universal. She is continuously sought after as a singer-performer. She has performed with Rod Stewart, Pink Martini, Snarky Puppy, and she's also appeared on albums by Celine Dion and Chaka Khan. This woman is a vocal powerhouse, so I'm really thrilled to introduce her to all of you. If you don't know her name already. So let's kick things off like I always do with a great song from Lucy called I Don't Know.
I don't know. I don't know. But he loves me so good till I think I should.
Joining me on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am very excited to finally pin you down for this interview.
Amazing. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Absolutely. So why don't we start with my favorite question I always ask my guests is to tell me about their childhood. Tell me about music, you know, in your childhood, the way, what kind of exposure you had growing up.
Well, I was exposed so super young because my parents were both classical musicians. My mom was an opera singer and a musicologist, and
wow.
My dad was a conductor and composer. So I was like literally born into a musical household, but it was really classical, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't really get into kind of pop music or other music till I was 12 or something. I think my mom, she let us have one Michael Jackson record, the Thriller record, because he sang in his falsetto. And as when you're raised by an opera singer, there are so many rules on how to sing right and not sing right. But Michael Jackson, she was totally cool with. So, and Prince, of course, they all sing super high. So, but I was born into that world. I was born in London, and then we moved to Amsterdam. And then my parents split, and my mom took my brother and I to New York and grew up there. We moved in with my grandparents for a while, who also, you know, played instruments and loved classical music. So that's all we kind of did. And then my mom, I remember she had a Beatles record from her youth, and I started really getting into that. And it was, you know, Yellow Submarine and just Michelle and my bell, and really listening to harmony, vocal harmonies and songwriting. So that was probably my first introduction to kind of songwriting and pop and drums even, you know, because it was just such a classical kind of household. And then I picked up the flute and played piano, and I had piano lessons with my grandmother. We had a teacher that came to the house, and we each got a lesson kind of back to back. It was like a grandma granddaughter kind of a double Aww. Lesson kind of thing. It was cute. And then played the flute and was in little, you know, sleepaway orchestra camps. And I never actually talk about this stuff, like the young stuff, because I went in a completely different direction as I got older. But you know, was reading, you know, in band and orchestra. And then I went to the mall when I was 12, and there were those karaoke kind of music minus one, you know, sound recording booth that you go in, you pay $20 and you get two recordings of you singing Madonna or something. And so I did that, and I said, I came home, I was like, Mom, I found my career. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to sing. And I wasn't very good. And there's like recordings of me singing like Material Girl, like, but I just knew it felt something connected with that, you know? So that was it. We moved to the Bronx, and being a flute player in band in the Bronx wasn't as cool as singing like in the gospel choir. So I ended up doing that and kind of like left the flute behind. And then it was just singing. Then it was plays and, you know, sheet girl ensembles, and starting to go to Manhattan to be in other productions and other plays and other groups. And then it was just like, that was it. It was singing. So that was my whole, you know, childhood and, you know, 3.5 minutes of like, of how musical the household was, even wow. before I got into like studying or career kind of thing, you know.
So when you have these parents who are incredibly, you know, obviously talented and I'm assuming like a lot of rigorous training, did you feel any, you know, before this, you know, this moment in the mall, did you have any sort of, I don't want to call it pressure, but sort of like this,
I know what you mean.
Push to go into, you know, sort of the rigorous classical training or anything like that?
No, I didn't feel a push, because I wanted to, like, I would play a couple hours of flute before I even went to school. I would play flute in the band room practicing. Like, I was kind of a little bit of a band nerd. This is elementary school. I would practice at lunch. I would go home and practice after school. I would do my homework, have dinner, and practice at night. So I really loved playing, and that is a really a classical state of mind. You know, you don't really do, I mean, I guess, and I don't know any other way. So I think that I had kind of my own discipline, but it wasn't, I wouldn't call it discipline, because I just wanted to do it. It was just sort of a fine line. But the only way, no one pushed me to go into music. It was all really natural. And it wasn't like, you know, you have to be a musician. I mean, I would never put that on like a child if I had that, like, you must, because it's such a hard, hard, crazy roller coaster business. I did feel pressures from my mom of singing correctly. When I got into singing more, she was afraid that I would ruin my voice, because, you know, she saw that I was listening to Annie or you know, Broadway records, and all these young kids were belting really hard on their chords, and opera singers don't do that. So there was a pressure of, don't sing like that, you're going to ruin your voice by the time you're 20. That it was more that, like a protective thing, which it took me a long time to shed those kind of you know, rules. You can't sing like that in this house, and don't, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It was tough because then I really wanted to sing pop music and wanted to sing at the top of my lungs. And, you know, so, but, and she still, I think, you know, we're super close, but she still is like, I don't, you know, when you sing that raspy thing, I don't know, is it good for you? And, you know, I'm like, Mom, it's under control. It's cool. I got this now. I'm a professional. So it, I can see it just like in her bones as an opera singer. She can't stand like the belting qualities that pop singers have, you know, that kind of thing. So that was the only pressure. It wasn't about, it was just about my actual muscle.
Yeah. Totally. And if this is, you know, her livelihood, it's understandable that she would be so protective of it. You were doing you were starting to gravitate towards plays, et cetera. So you're in New York. Did you think about doing this in college, or what was kind of your next steps?
I auditioned for Manhattan School of Music. She came home one day. I was in junior year, and she goes, "I have this idea. Let's try to get you into Manhattan School of Music early. You like skip a grade." And she did the same thing. She kind of skipped her last year at Hunter, or I think she went there, and she in New York. And so I went. I auditioned, and I had to prepare a few jazz standards and do some sight reading and ear training, but I didn't have a high school diploma, so I went and I auditioned. It was kind of like the panel in Fame when she's doing, you know, the final audition at the end. There are all these people, and they said, you know, you're 16, you don't have a high school diploma. Are you aware of that? You know, you really need to have a high school diploma to be in the school. And I said, yeah, I'm aware. I just thought I'd just try it. And they let me in. Like, I guess I was okay. I'm not like a super, super jazz singer, but I was listening to a lot of jazz and vocalists at that time. So I think they wanted to kind of broaden their department of, you know, there's classical, there's jazz, and then there's like the commercial department. So I went in early and did kind of my last year of high school and freshman year of college at the same time, which was a lot. I mean, I didn't have to do that many more credits in high school, but it was a full load for a 16-year-old kid, you know. Mm-hmm. And I had just moved into the dorm on 110th Street, so I just turned 17, and it was still like still a kid, you know. Yeah. And then you're suddenly in this world of bebop and a lot of homework and a lot of pressure to be like a jazz singer. And I remember them putting me in. You know, they put all the singers in a jazz ensemble that you work with every week. And I wanted to just sing Aretha and Gladys Knight. And they said, can you just sing My Funny Valentine? And I was like, oh, I have to learn it. They're like, you don't know My Funny Valentine? You know, so I wanted to, I knew then, I was like, I don't belong here. So I left after a year and kind of hit the streets and joined cover bands and wedding bands and did jingles and then actually became like a professional singer, you know, and like slash waitress, but that eventually went away. So that was like the beginning of the career, the transition from school into career, just taking every job that came along, every jam session, sitting in, writing, you know, starting my own band, that kind of thing.
Well, can you kind of expand on that? Because I think that sometimes I think when you sort of leave the comforts of school and that support system and then striking out on your own can be so overwhelming. Can you speak a little bit about that sort of, if you can remember, you know, did you have any kind of plan or, you know, a vision or anything like that?
I guess when you're that young and you're coming out of this kind of vicious school schedule and you go, okay, I'm done with that. I remember waiting tables, you know, in the East Village and West Village. And I think because of the way I was raised, I have a strong discipline. You know, sometimes I want to like eat better, like work out more. But when it comes to music, I really was like putting myself through kind of boot camp, you know? Mm-hmm. And I said, if I'm going to go do this and leave school and be in, you know, wait tables in the day and do gigs or whatever at night, and then I have to make sure that on the days that I'm free, I have to still kind of discipline myself because I have so much to learn. I mean, I still feel that today. I have so much to learn about music. And so I remember a friend of mine gave me their apartment. They had like a real 9-to-5 job. So they said, here's the key, 9-to-5, it's all yours. So I woke up, have a coffee. I would go there. I would do, you know, 45 minutes of just scales. I would do the next 3 hours of just listening to records and imitating vocalists and just really getting different, you know, jazz and soul and, you know, learning phrasing and style. And then the next 2 hours I would do like I'm going to work on lyrics, even though I wasn't really much of a writer. So I kind of put myself through boot camp because it was like going to the office at my friend's house who had a, you know, a piano. Mm-hmm. So that was like, I knew that, well, I wanted to learn how to sing shit. I wanted to just like learn what it was, like the what it was to just build your range and hit high notes and hit low notes and do riffs and things, you know? So that was my kind of structure. So leaving the comfort of school, I knew that I was in my territory. Like I was happy singing. Okay. What's the next step? Okay. You go to every jam session possible on Bleecker Street. There was a Bitter End Sunday night jam there. I remember being on stage and it was like Gavin DeGraw was also the open. Yeah. It was like that kind of thing. And people they knew they could work on their material there. You go up and I remember him singing Marvin Gaye or Bill Withers or something. And I sang Michael Jackson and, you know, Alanis Morissette maybe. And then the same thing happened at Cafe Wa on McDougal Street or Thompson, whatever street it's on. And you go in and sit in with the house band and, you know, that kind of thing. So you're just doing that wherever you can, because I had never really sung with bands before. It's very different from singing in your bedroom, you know?
Right.
And that was a whole different other muscle to you singing in front of bands, singing louder and stronger and with more presence and not being shy. Now there's a microphone that you have to hold, so you're being amplified. It's a really different mentality, you know? And then joined like a real wedding band and was doing, you know, 5 weddings a weekend. And I was able to quit waiting tables and started doing jingles and commercials. So then somebody put a guitar in my hands and I would, you know, learning songs, learning chords. And now I started imitating songwriters and Fiona Apple and Sheryl Crow, who I worship, and Alanis around that time, and Joan Osborne. And so that was a sort of era of young, you know, of the new songwriter who is amazing, who's blowing my mind right now. And even though it's coming from a soul singing approach, these are amazing songwriters, all of these women. So I got into that and then had my first few songs and then had my first band and then had my first gig. And again, you start off by, or I started off by going to, you know, maybe the Sidewalk Cafe on Avenue A, and it's like a songwriter night and you have to sit around for 3 hours and wait for your turn to get up and sing a song, and you test it out, you know, you try it out, you see how that song feels. And then slowly you do that enough, and then you have a set of music, and then you have your first gig, and then your second gig, and then you get the gist of it. But it's so natural. It just felt like once I said, okay, this is what it wasn't like, I'm going to be a star. It wasn't that. It was like, I need to go sing. Where can I go sing? Mm. I need to go sing. It was a really different brain, you know?
It sounds like New York I've obviously visited New York, but I've never lived there, but it sounds like sounds pretty intimate. It sounds like, you can go to these places and it's, you know, it's the place to go or the places to go, you know, and nurture this. What was that? Can you talk a little bit about the New York environment for
musicians? Totally. Oh, it's really my home. Absolutely. And I don't know how it is now because people seem to be leaving all the time. Hmm. But I was just there, you know, a few days ago and it's still an amazing energy, but I don't know what it's like to be a young musician or songwriter in New York right now. It's also really expensive to live. At that time, I think that for whatever you want to do in New York, whether it's being an acrobat or a math teacher or a librarian or a musician, you're going to find it in New York. You're always going to find your people. You're going to find your tribe. So that is harder to do for people in smaller cities or villages. They have to travel far to just go to an open jam or a karaoke, you know, at night, you know. So that New York is just the, you know, creme de la creme for that. You have everything you need a subway ride away, whatever you're into. So that's the cool thing about New York. It was always, you know, I want to sing, you know, death metal. Great. There's a club down the street. They're going to let you do that. You know, that kind of thing. So that, it was a safe place. There's an edginess in New York. I would tell anybody this, you know, 10 years ago or now, that if you're going to move to New York and test it out, which I do think everybody should live as an artist, there's a different kind of grind there. And it's a hard city to learn it's a hard city to actually be in, but I'm kind of like fourth generation New Yorker. It's like in my bones, but you definitely have to have thick skin to be there. But if anyone at whatever age wants to move there, to do music, you have to be just so good. You have to know songs in like every key. You have to be ready to jump on stage and sit in at any given time and be available to be a sub, you know, be a sub, just know songs, be ready to change the key at any time. If a singer's like, no, I want to do it a half step higher, you know, you just are ready to flow with that. And that is a lot of pressure. I find that going to other cities and other countries, you know, depending what, you know, what age and what style of music, I think it's good to have that pressure because it should be the best people, you know, performing and trying it out. I think New York is just like a really tough audience. You have to be good. If you fall on your face, you have to be so like strong on the inside to just pick yourself up and show up again the next week. And then you get another shot. And that just goes, it just goes like that over and over until you start. Because part of the falling down part is also part of the process of picking yourself up, and you have to do it again. It's the only way. You can't just learn that out of school, how to be like awesome and thick skinned. That's how you create that kind of thing. So, but it's a tough audience there. There's a part of you, I think when I was young and I was, you know, 21, whatever, 22, and doing these open jams in bars for the first time, you're so blinded by, I just want to sing, I love music, that I can imagine it when you're older, having more fear and being insecure about getting up for the first time. All these people, they don't like me. They want to see me fail. There's like a whole other set of insecurities as you get older. You're 21. You're still a kid. Like, you know, where's the next jam session? You're just going with whatever flow. So, but if you just, no one gives a shit about age or anything. They just want to hear you do well. Like people, there'll be people in the audience who want to see you fail because they want to do well. But people do want to be blown away. I mean, that's just going to be anywhere, like the competitiveness. But you want to do well, and people are on your side because they want to come back and be blown away by the talent there. And that's what creates a really strong musical community. And that's what I had in New York. So
wow, that's really powerful.
Long-winded way of saying that.
No, not at all. It's great because I think, again, I mean, I'm from Boston, so I do have that sort of, I do think that there's a difference with the East Coast, West Coast, and the East Coast. It's just like, it's similar.
Did you go to Berkeley?
No, I didn't actually. I went to Indiana for 1 year.
Oh,
but
cool,
but I'm very familiar with Berkeley. And
yes, you get it.
Yeah, I get it. And it's just
there's an East Coast mentality. I think it's
it really
tougher.
Is. It's like so what? Like that's like you know, like you're not so special. So and you just kind of go, oh, okay, well.
So you keep going, and it's and I didn't have this feeling of like I'm gonna prove to them. You don't just keep going. It's just sort of like what you do, like you brush your teeth and you just keep going, you know.
Yeah,
but I don't find that the same angst and grind in LA the same way. But I didn't grow up here, so I live now, I don't feel that there. I don't feel it from the young kids. I don't feel it from the scene, but it is a different scene. I don't think it's as much of a live scene as New York was, you know.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So you had this incredible foundation, you know, sort of trial by fire. And where did you decide to go next? Did you sort of outgrow New York, or what happened?
Oh, I only moved to LA about 8 years ago. But
I
did. Yeah, no, I really stayed in New York for a long time. And, you know, I had a band, and then I started talking to record labels, and they would come down and reject me, and then I'd go and sing in their offices when I had more songs. And they're like, yeah, great, come back when you have a hit. And, you know, I went through that a million times. And then I was like, well, that was my new, okay, just keep going. Go write better songs. Go work on your voice more. Go work on your stage presence, you know, whatever it is. Did that for the next few years. And then I signed with Epic, Sony, Tommy Mottola, who was, I think, married to Mariah Carey at that time.
Yeah.
He signed me, and sort of a record that never really got made or finished. It was one of those big deals that just went away really fast. Mm-hmm. And then 9/11 happened, and then no one was signing. And then shortly afterwards, I was writing more songs, and people were just so terrified of 9/11. It was like the stupid music A&R industry world of saying, 9/11. It just happened. The world is blowing up. We're not finding artists. Like everyone was just freaking out about like the, so, which was just a lame excuse for we don't really like you enough to sign you. But they blamed it on 9/11, which is so silly. So then, but it happened over and over again. And then I wrote this song called Dumb Girls with my manager at the time, Vinnie Poncia, and my friend and co-writer then, Kevin Kadish, who basically developed Meghan Trainor and wrote all of her songs. And we wrote a song called Dumb Girl, and then it got into the right hands at Atlantic Records, and I signed, and then was like the top 40 kind of pop thing running around on like MTV, and I went on Jay Leno, and that was like, then I was in the industry. Then it was like, okay, now I'm in the industry, and it was just a whole other life than what I had come from.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, so this is the new reality. So if you can talk a little bit about that and just your experience with that and, you know, how it affected you, how it affected your outlook, et cetera, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, it's, I already been brokenhearted from getting, you know, dropped from the Sony thing. And then you go, okay, you write more songs, keep going. And I had a really amazing publisher at Warner Chappell, Judy Stakey, who, you know, was working with Sheryl Crow and Jewel and Michelle Brandt. So she was really great, you know, strong woman, who's still a very close friend of mine, who said, okay, we're going to get you a record deal again. You know, you lost the first one, we're getting you a record deal. You're going to work with this writer and this writer. We're going to go to the mall and we're going to buy new, we're just going to create, like, forget that young girl thing. Let's make you a woman, like, let's make you an artist. It was sort of, you know, it was just a strong mentor in my life, still to this day. She said, you have to take yourself more seriously. It was more like that conversation without saying those words, you know. But I was now in the pop world, and the night before my album came out, I was on Jay Leno and performed and got like a little couch time and everything. And, you know, I went to the Virgin Megastore on Sunset afterwards with my friends, and there was like my big poster or whatever above the cash registers, like, you know, those light boxes on the wall. And
yeah.
It was very surreal. Like, I was like, okay, we're in this now. And you kind of think, especially that age, you think, okay, this is how it is for the rest of my life. This is, wow, I'm in, you know, I don't even know what that means now, but I'm in. And I think I was on VH1 and maybe a little MTV, you know, and doing commercials for, you know, girl products and music, you know, Pantene and that kind of. So it was a very different world. Now I was like a commercial top 40 radio person. And then after a year and change of that, I was like, okay, I'm going to start writing the next record. President gets fired. A lot of the artists that he signed also get let go at that time. And then you're just, that's it. It's over.
Wow.
Your song's not on the radio anymore. And it was I was in a van with my band for 7 months, jumping from radio station to radio station, you know, many stations a day, exhausted, you know, just exhausted. But of course this is what you do because you're on the radio. And so that all went away within a year and a half later. And then I took all my savings from royalties or whatever I had left over, and I moved in with my then boyfriend, and he had a studio in the basement, and we made a new record. And then I was this is going to be an indie record. So it was I said, forget all that pop shit from before. This is like, I need to go back to kind of my jazzier soul, horn arrangements, things like that. So we did this whole record in our basement for a couple of years and then put that out. And I was now officially like an indie artist. And that was a whole different ball game. I mean, I had a few press things and Billboard did a nice little like write up, but it was very, you know, it's just a very different world. And during that time, Verve Records started coming to see my shows in New York, and I was gigging a lot, and they sort of just were keeping an eye on me. And then they wanted to sign me, and then I did my third record with them, with Tony Visconti produced most of it, and it was more kind of jazz pop swing, more a little more big band, kind of 60s, touches of 60s Brill Building and things like that. So then I was sort of back in the like industry again in a different way. And anyway, so that, I mean, I did another record after that, which I put out a year and a half ago. There's so many like little stories in between, you know, how you get to one deal to the next. So the Sony Epic thing, that Tommy Mottola thing, that didn't really happen. There's that. Then there's like the Atlantic big pop star thing. Then there's the indie record where no one remembers who you are and you use all of your money to make your next record. Then it's like a jazz label, which they take you seriously as an artist. My demographic opened up because I was singing on jazz festivals. So suddenly, like, in an adult world of people who bought records and they liked CDs and they didn't download stuff for free. That was kind of a new thing also. And the people just love to go see jazz concerts. You know, they loved to going to festivals. So I was a very different world of an audience that took me seriously, as opposed to the 12-year-old audience, which is a serious audience, but a very young audience, you know, from many years before. And then, so I put up this record on Verve in 2010, and then kind of doors opened up, and then I started working with Snarky Puppy and Mike League, who's the bass player of that band and leader of that band. It's his band. He was my bass player for a while, and we did some touring together. He said, come on the road with me and my band Snarky Puppy, open for us, and we just started a lifelong collaboration, writing, producing, you know, singing with them, opening for them. They're all my super, super brothers. Aww. And at the same time, that same year, Pink, this is 2012 or 11, Pink Martini, I went to fill in for the lead singer who had a vocal surgery, China Forbes. So I went to fill in for 6 months of singing in Croatian and Turkish and French. And that was another whole other thing that I was involved in, where I was like, wow, I actually, this is, my world is still, I'm still learning so much about singing. And now I'm using all the opera kind of chops that my mother raised me with that I didn't really tap into, but I'm bringing that from like my really young childhood into this new kind of classical jazz world, singing at Montreal Jazz Fest. So it was really like a huge arch, but I knew I had left that young pop thing behind, because now I started taking myself more seriously, so therefore other people did. But it was a lot of shedding that kind of image of the girl with the jeans and the sneakers and MTV. You know, I had to become a different artist, even though I do consider myself still a pop writer, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was a really different world. I feel like it was just another life.
Well, if you could, I was going to say, sorry, I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about, because I think that's what makes you such a worldly artist, but such an experienced artist, because you've had exposure and success in all these different markets. So I'm wondering if you can just talk a little bit about, because it seems like, I don't know, it's funny listening to your trajectory. Like, it seems like you are always kind of one step ahead of the industry in a way, which is great, you know, and you sort of forged your own path. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what do you think it takes, say, if somebody did want to be the pop star, you know, like what would you say, what does that take for an artist to do that? Or what did it seem like when you were in it that you sort of had to commit to if you were really going to try to push it all the way or whatever?
So if I met like a young girl now or whatever, young, whatever age, and she said, hey, can you give me some advice? I want to be a pop star, or I want to be a pop singer. I want to,
how do I do that? So right. How do I do that?
Yeah. Right. So I always think number one is the best songs you can have, whether they're written for you or whether you write them. Do not rush to just get a body of work, like get the best songs, the stuff that is different, you know, it has concept songs, you know, like when Rihanna was always around, Rihanna then suddenly had Umbrella, and that went boom, pop. She came out of the urban world and was just like, she was already a pop kind of, you know, well known. And then Umbrella put her in top, like number one pop radio.
Yeah.
And so that, when that song, or like Avril Lavigne, this was really going back, but like that song Complicated, her first single, like these are really amazing, amazing songs, you know? Mm-hmm. And I mean, whether you like the music or not, they're great songs. And so that it's songs first, and obviously you want your tracks to be banging, because back in the day you had demo deals or development deals with labels where you're a great singer, you know, you have a cool sound, whatever. Okay, but we're going to give you a development deal to develop your sound. I know you have some songs, but we need you to have more songs, and we're going to fly you to whatever, somewhere to work with this producer to develop your sound. And there was budget back then for experimentation. So the girl, who's a lot of these kids are so young, they don't have a sound yet. They're like just barely out of school or still right. in school. So, I mean, they might have a tone in their voice, which is really important. Anyway, so the songs are important, the mm-hmm. lyrics. And I'm not talking like throw your hands in the air, party all night in the club songs. I'm not talking that. I'm talking like, you know, songwriting. And I'm not saying that's not songwriting. It's just a different, it's not the genre I'm talking about. So the tracks have to be banging. Now everything has to sound like a record upon first delivery to, for example, a label or mm-hmm. posting it online, whatever, you know, your route is for, you know, getting music out there, whether you're an indie artist or not. And before, you have a demo, song demo, and then there's budget, you get a record deal, and then there's budget to record a band and mix it and master it. And now that isn't around anymore. That doesn't mm-hmm. come from the labels anymore because there's no money in music the same way because everything is free. So the budgets are just obviously way less. So right, I think the difference now between then and now is that the songs and the tracks have to be banging and they have to sound like records from moment one. There's room for development. Like this song, Dumb Girls, I had, it was a demo. It was a demo that we did in Kevin's bedroom. And then when I got signed on it, the only thing we added were drums. We didn't change any vocals. Wow. We just added live drums. That was it. Mm-hmm. And Kevin did the same thing with Megan Trainor, who he wrote All About That Bass. Mm-hmm. And it was a demo. And then I think they just mastered it and that was it. I mean, he has that kind of luck. Not everybody has that. His records are always really strong. Mm-hmm. So, but that's the difference between now and then. So the songs, number one priority, have to be so solid. The tracks have to be banging. Mixes have to be great. The vocals have to be awesome, you know, mm-hmm. like stellar. Awesome. And then I always think music is the most important thing and what the body of work is. You should be able to perform it. You should be able to sing it live anywhere, depending on what your gig is. If you have a band or if you're like a DJ band, you know, whether can you sing your set, can you sing a set, whether it's 20 minutes or a 45 minute show in a club, in a music venue, can you do this live? Because that's what's going to make you different from the people who can't. That's going to mm-hmm. take you to the next level. Then you can tour. Once you have that, you can tour and you can get a string of dates together. Mm-hmm. And then you're able to do this live, and that's how an artist now can make their money. And it's super hard at first, and you're squished in the van, and you're shoving everyone in one hotel room, but that's just the way it is. And then you have merch, and you can sell merch on the road. So I mm-hmm. think the road is everything, but if you have a strong live set and keep hitting those cities over and over and do the rounds again the next year or 6 months later, whatever it is, that is where I think that's always going to make the difference in just having a cool song on the, that sounds good online, basically, because everything, people listen to everything online now. So no record stores. So you have to prove it in so many other ways. Even mm-hmm. like awesome videos are not doing it the same way. Like no one cares because you're just watching a video on Instagram for 1 minute. It's like a 59 second clip that you can do. So how else are you going to do it? Do you like live singing? You know, yes, okay, then you have to just get out there and go do it. And that's mm-hmm. it. So, and hopefully someone catches it on, and then the next time you come back, someone tells their friend, and they tell their friend, and that's how you build a fan base. Mm-hmm. And that's outside of the online presence. You know, that's outside of social media. That's just what to do. The social media, I know it's really, really strong. I mean, really important, and we all do it. But it's that should be like the bonus supplement thing that is... You can't rely on that to make you, I don't know. Sometimes I'm blown away by social. I'm saying something because I'm like being idealistic about it. But like sometimes I'm like, how did that person get so, you know, huge just from a social media presence? There's no art under there. There's no music. There's no substance. But mm-hmm. some people slip through and people like them for whatever reason. But it's not my world, you know.
Yeah, totally. Well, let's pivot now to the whole like jazz, or as you called it, like the grown-ups, which I love. And it's funny because I just interviewed this great guy who's a senior vice president at A&R Worldwide, and he was saying, you know, he feels like baby boomers and Gen Xers are like the most underserved market. And he's like, and we've mm-hmm. got disposable income, and we will buy like top dollar for tickets and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, and you were saying like, this is kind of a different demographic and, you know, mm-hmm. still buy a CD. So I wonder if you can just talk about that and being in that,
now
being in that world and, you know, what are sort of the ins and outs of that world and being a top artist in that field.
Well, I think a perfect example in that world, I'll just take Snarky Puppy because they're my very close friends and we do a lot of work together and I've seen their growth, where they were 9 guys shoved in a van and they'd have 4 guys to a hotel room at Motel 6 just to keep the cost low. And their tickets were in clubs, you know, $10 or free, you know, and they'd crash on people's, you know, floors if they had to, just to keep going. And then they were able to charge a little bit more money. And then they did master classes and clinics at schools, and they were, because they had a whole educational side to them. And then that was a different audience that opened up to kids who actually really loved music and wanted to know who wanted to be them. You know, they just they loved their approach to making music. It wasn't just jazz. It was gospel. It was kind of like jazz fusion with strong gospel roots. And then there's hip hop. And now it's like way more international. The sound is Turkish and Cuban, you know?
Oh, wow.
So it's like they've opened up that I just saw them play in LA 3 nights ago. And it's just the subtlety is so deep. So now they're able to, they just played some of them played at, you know, Carnegie Hall last month, or they play the biggest festival. They're at the top of their game. They can charge more. There are more expenses. There's 28 rotating members. So there are a lot of costs now and gear, but they completely deserve it. They earned it so, so, so hard. And that is a struggle and you have to be so determined to make that work. And it's just a vision. You have that on and you keep going and then it just keeps developing. So watching them and then doing it in my own band separately, going from smaller clubs where you charge $15, whatever it is, and have a student discount, and then you play a theater where they'll charge $50 to $100 per ticket, you can tell at the merch table, it's, you know, because you meet people afterwards and say hi and you talk to them and, you know, so it's a different world because these are older people who they still want to buy CDs and they still listen to CDs in their car and they don't have an iPhone and they just want to play records and play vinyl. And that's so nice. I mean, I still listen to CDs in the car because I still like the idea of it and, you know, and I don't know, I just have CDs and I still listen to CDs, but, that's me. It's a whole other generation. Everything is free or an MP3 and the quality is different and all that. But at shows, you do see, yes, I will pay $20 for your CD. And you know what? Give me this CD and this CD, and I'll just keep, here's just $100 for all your merch. And you actually are like, no, don't overspend your money. You know, don't do that. please. But people are very passionate about it. They want to walk away with something. That's the big thing. Like, whether it's a T-shirt, they want to walk away with something, not just a ticket saying that they were at your show. And that's a really different demographic. Mm-hmm. It's also a different type of, you could be 21 years old and be that passionate also. So I'm not saying it's just like an older generation, but it's like music fans, people who just love music. They love to feel, they thrive
it's
on concerts.
It's an investment almost, it seems like.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And they're going for this incredible experience. Like they want to go like the Hollywood Bowl or whatever, you know, the Montreal Jazz Festival, like they're going for this incredible experience. You know,
exactly. And the same way, like people love going to baseball, they go to the, you know, World Series and they want to come home with the T-shirt and the hat and the bat. And they want to buy all the merch shirts. You know, I was singing backup vocals for Rod Stewart for 4.5 years. I left about a year and a half ago. And yeah, it was a great job. And I learned so much from him and saw the world and the band as a family. It was like incredible job. And that merch, you know, that's 30, 40 years of, what's he now, 73. So yeah, he's been making records since he was a kid. And that merch table is filled with tons of records and tons of shirts. And every season or every tour, there's new T-shirts to be sold. And these, you know, the fans are diehard. They come back and they are wearing the new T-shirt and there are some fans who have seen him hundreds of times, you know, and they've just grown with him. And I see that in certain bands now. You just watch these fans like Snarky Puppy. You've seen, you know, you'll see little kids show up because they're like saxophone nerds. And in 10 years, they're still going to be going. You know, they're all grown up. You grow with these bands. It's a journey. It's a time you know, the way you saw a band when you were young, and or you listened to a record when you're young, it's like it helps you through a period in your life, or it's a soundtrack of your life. So yeah, if you have that in your bedroom, you might as well have it, you know, you have it live if you like going to see live.
Yeah.
Live music.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So do you, what's kind of your outlook now? Like what's coming down the pike for you, and where do you see yourself headed in the next, you know, few years?
It's such an interesting, I mean, I think it changes monthly.
Yeah.
because opportunities come up that also, or opportunities go away, and, you know, you kind of roll, there's just something I've definitely learned that you have to really roll with this business. Mm. And as long as you love, this is me, I'm saying you, but, you know, like, as long as I love singing, then that's my goal. That's what I do, right? Mm. And so I have to always remember that. I did it as a kid, and I do it now. I will sing till the day I die. And there'll be, that's just what I do. How can I do that in whatever awesome way that I can, whether it's a project, a tour, a record, it might just be a 1 month tour, it might be a 2 year project, whatever it is, how can I do that and remain like soulfully happy, you know? So last month, it's a funny example. Charlie Hunter is a well-known guitarist, phenomenal guitarist, and he sort of a friend that we know through each other through music, and he called me and he said, I had a singer who I was supposed to do this tour with, but she got denied her visa from Mexico the day before their tour was supposed to start, which is horrible because she's really, really amazing. He was producing and working with her and developing her, and she got her visa denied. Mm-hmm. Can you jump in on this tour? It's the next 3 weeks. Can you fly out, you know, the day after tomorrow? We'll do a whole different body of work. Well, I know that you're such a, you know, blues singer. We'll do standards. We'll do Nina Simone. We'll do blues tunes, whatever. And let's get this going. And can you do it? And I moved a few things, and I was able to get on, like, you know, the next plane a couple of days later. And I just got back 2 nights ago. And that was one of those things when Charlie called me, I was like, oh, my God, this is totally nuts. I haven't worked with him yet. It's just going to be a trio. So it'd be Charlie, me, and a percussion player who I know, he's one of Snarky's percussion players. And I got there, we had an hour rehearsal, and we just hit the road and hit whatever, if it was first for Virginia or something, and went down the coast to Miami, came back, went to Nashville, and did New York and Connecticut, and got home a few days ago. So that's one of these things where I'm planning on going to Europe in a few weeks for a couple of months, actually, and I'm now in this mode of, okay, tour managing, okay, we're going to take a plane there, we'll take a train there. I'm a little bit in that brain. And then Charlie calls me. He's like, okay, let's go sing. And I'm like, yes, what do I have to do to just go sing? Because now I'm in, like, admin world. You're in tour, yeah, you know, it's like paperwork and boring and visas. And so then he's like, you know, oh, and but that I realize now after a few times in my life, like Pink Martini, I was an emergency sub because China Forbes had to go and get an immediate vocal operation. She couldn't do another show.
Wow.
So I just jumped in and learned all these weird languages in 5 days. Rod Stewart, I was like another sub. Hey, girl's having a baby. Can you fill in, you know, until she comes back, whatever. And then I ended up staying for 4.5 years. So like there's this really cool thing about being a sub. You go in, it's not quite your gig yet, but you're still like your world has been changed. So between Charlie Hunter, Pink Martini, and Rod Stewart, like my world was changed just by a total accident happening, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that is like, I've learned as a singer or an artist, whatever you want to call it, to roll. So you have to roll with it and just kind of be ready to sing at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I did that from like jumping in, you know, jam sessions and just say yes to everything. Not everything. As you get older, you can't say yes to everything, but I've learned so much from those 3 gigs alone. And that's outside of my record making, my own records, just the projects, live tours, just by saying yes and making, just changing your dentist appointment and doing your taxes later and whatever it is, like you just do it, just go
mm-hmm.
do it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, and who knows what that tour is going to be, but you just have to jump in. So I feel like that is something, I forgot the original question, but it's just something that I would, you know, anyway, I would tell a young singer that, but I know that wasn't the question.
No. It's, believe me, the questions are arbitrary. Like this,
okay.
this is such good wisdom. And I think what I'm hearing from you, which is so great, you know, is you're like, I'm a singer first and foremost. And
yeah.
So when these opportunities arose, instead of getting in your head of like, well, is this who I really am? And is this really what I want to do? And is this really what I want to commit to? And blah, 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 blah. Like, you were like, bam, I'm ready. Like that. And I think totally, that takes a lot of guts too. You know, I got to give you a lot of, you know, major props for that, because I would have been like, you know, but the fact that you were like, I'm ready. I can do this, you know?
Yeah. What you're saying, there is validity to that. Also, I remember after my first record deal and being dropped, and then I had a friend who was working on American Idol or something, I can't remember. And he said, Lucy, that song that you have called Slow Recovery, which is a song, an old song of mine. There's a way that I can pitch it to whether it was someone on American Idol or something like that. And I remember at that time I go, wait, that's my, or someone wants to pitch it to Celine Dion. And it was this, it's a big pop ballad. And I remember going, oh God, but that's my song. A song that like no one ever really ever heard. But I'm like, that's my song. I was precious. No way. I can't just sell out and be, you know, give it to Celine Dion. And all my smart songwriter friends were like, girl, you better get rid of that song. You better give that to Celine Dion, you know, that kind of thing. And then, you know, they're just like, you have no idea how hard this business is yet. And I was like, but I'm an artist. And I went through that precious stage.
Yeah.
And
I love that. And then precious. Eventually, that's of course, the perfect word, precious. Yeah.
Precious. You're so precious, but I'm an artist. I would never sing that, you know?
Yeah.
Does Meryl Streep think that? Like, does Meryl Streep think she's an artist and like she's doing Sophie's Choice or whatever, you know, Bridges of Madison County? She transforms herself because she's an actor. Now, not every singer can do that. I'm not saying, you know, Alanis Morissette can jump into a pink martini gig. It's like not every singer can or is able to do that vocally. Mm-hmm. But I do come from a lot of different styles of music, being raised the way I was or, you know, whatever. And so I love that. If I don't have different kind of projects going on, I've always been like that. I've always had different bands and different styles of singing. And I think that came from session singing a lot. And one day I had to be Janis Joplin and the next day I had to be, you know, Enya. It's easy, it's fun, it's challenging. I can't do everything, but, you know, that I was like, I'm game. I'm just like, I'm game. Like I am game, you know? So that's where, you know, not everybody can do that. But I remember being, you know, a younger artist going, you know, Celine Dion can't have my song. What do you mean? You know, and you know, she didn't end up cutting it or anything, but it was, you know, it's one of these things you do go through of like, I'm the artist, you know?
Yeah.
And so it does get it, everyone does go through that, you know, the world is changing. So you just never know what like amazing surprises are around the corner. And that's just the way the music business is.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Well, you know, how can people find you?
I guess this website world is, you know, www.lucywoodward.com or Facebook. You know, Instagram is Miss Lucy Woodward. Twitter, you know, I feel like everyone can find anybody these days. So.
Okay. Just Google.
Just Google. I can't believe I actually just said www. I can't believe that.
World Wide Web. Yeah. Oh, this is so great. Well, I'm so happy and thrilled that I was finally able to snag you after your whirlwind running on tour.
Thank you for having me and being patient. I think it's such a cool podcast that you know, that you have. And thank you. I think it's important, this part of like the touring aspect of it and, you know, the business side, not just, you know, how do you start out? It's like, this is a really important side of, music, which I think can't be celebrated enough.
So there you have it, another great interview. Thank you so much to Lucy for taking the time out of her insanely busy schedule to speak with me and to share with all you her incredible experience and all the nuggets of wisdom that she has gained along the way. Definitely go and follow her, lucywoodward.com, LucyWoodward.com or the Lucy Woodward on Instagram, etc. She is just such a powerhouse and such an incredible pleasure. Definitely see her live. That's how I was first introduced to her, and she will just blow the doors off of any performance that she gives. So if you do get a chance to see her live, do not miss it. Okay, so we are done with this episode. Thank you so much for hanging with me through my silly head cold. I am your host, L Ariel. You can find me at LARIELmusic.com. That's LARIELmusic.com. I am also on social media. And you can also obviously find me on the podcast website, musicjobspodcast.com, musicjobswithanspodcast.com. See y'all next week. Have a wonderful week full of cold free and illness free vibes I am sending your way. And again, what are we going to do? We're going to keep on hustling. We're going to push through that dream, and don't you dare give up.